Let's get behind the information curtain and talk access and options. You're listening to the Information Asymmetry Podcast with Montana Bush, brought to you by Thin Edge Production. Now, sit down and put your headphones on. It's time to roll.
Hello, and welcome to an episode of Information Asymmetry. I am your host, Montana. Here is the interview supporting How to Game the System, Part 1 and Part 2. For today's episode, we're lucky to be joined by two-time Olympian David Banks and, as always, Mike Wilson. David, I want to follow up quickly on that high school experience. For those people that don't know, getting into Stanford is no small achievement. It's what, one or two or maybe third in terms of the most difficult schools in the country to get into. So clearly you were academically qualified to get in as you didn't go through the recruitment path. And that puts you on par, you know, to all the Ivy Leagues and all the other aforementioned schools that you spoke about. As a person of color yourself, did it come across to you that being a person of color, you could leverage that reality to improve your odds to getting into school? And was that very much kind of, you know, in either the back of your mind or in the forefront of your mind? Because for me, once I realized I was getting recruitment calls from Ivy League schools and I'm a white male, but I'm in a sport that they care about, it very much was obvious to me. It's like, wait a minute, I have an opportunity. I have a card to play, and it is my rowing acumen and my academics are of a standard. And that was something that, you know, comes across in the article. I was, you know, keenly made aware of there being an access point that was being made available to me. But because you didn't go the recruitment path, I'm curious if was being a person of color something that you thought, wait a minute, I can leverage this to my benefit because not only am I smart, but I have this other card to play and that will improve my odds at a school like this. Did that ever come across as either kind of an implicit or an explicit level of motivation for you?
No, I'm not really, not to that extent, you know, and I think it's a testament to my folks and my parents, you know, my dad's African American, my mom's Jewish, and, you know, my dad grew up in, you know, Southwest Kentucky. You know, he went to a segregated high school until he was, you know, in 10th grade. And, you know, from day one, you know, he always taught us the history of the family, where we came from. You know, his grandfather, my great-grandfather, was a genius, right? He could have been owner of a company, a brilliant, you know, owner of a construction company, could just great with his hands and all those things. But, you know, he's Black in the turn of the century in Southwest Kentucky. So he worked in the coal mine his whole life, right? And so my dad, from day one, my mom as well, you know, was taught pretty much that we had to work, you know, 10-20% harder than others, right? We didn't have that kind of that slack to be able to not, right? Because we were always going to be tested regardless of where we came from because of, you know, what we look like, right? And it was always going to be at the front that you had to go that extra bit because you were always going to be, you know, you're always going to be tested. So really that wasn't really the focus. It was almost you have to push as hard as you can because you don't know, you know, you may not have another opportunity or something may not come through, I think. So it's more along that vein, right? I mean, I guess I wasn't definitely aware of affirmative action, you know, and even my dad's career, you know, I would think he was a brilliant man and he's talented beyond, you know, he earned it, right? But I think affirmative action probably definitely helped him, or, you know, without it, he wouldn't have been recognized for his abilities, right? And so I think I was aware of it, aware of affirmative action, but it was never, you know, the foot was on the gas pedal regardless of that, right? The foot was on the gas pedal because if you don't work that 10-20% harder, you may not, others may, you know, you may not be there. And which I think, you know, coincidentally translated well into rowing, into sports. But yeah, it wasn't necessarily a sense of, I guess, of leveraging it in that sense. It was more awareness of it. You know, I wasn't blind to the fact, but, it, you know, the foot was on the gas pedal without having that, without that awareness, I guess, if that makes sense.
So, David, you probably, because of the support and the encouragement of your family, were going to go to high-achieving post-secondary, secondary institution. And, in fact, you got accepted into Stanford for your academics as opposed to your athletics. But for a lot of kids of color, I think when they go into school, their main motivator, especially those that are in the traditional sports, football, basketball, track, their primary motivation is to use the school as a way to launch that sport endeavor.
Yeah.
the fact that you went to a school with so many high-achieving other students, do you think the fact that you had a bigger networking pool of successful high-achieving students versus those that go to some school just because they want to play sports and their networking is mostly people who are in that sport? So I guess what advice would you give young students, especially that of color, low economic background, that may get an offer to college to take advantage of the networking abilities that they will have beyond just their fellow teammates?
Yeah, no, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I think, you know, I think that's one of the things, you know, I talk about, you know, I talk to kids too, you know, talking about, you know, getting involved in different things or different sports. You just come across as different people, right? And you never know those organic interactions, what they can do and how they can change your life, right? And so, you know, I think that, yeah, definitely talking to myself, going back, is to always just be open to new opportunities and new people. I mean, I was open to new opportunity, right? Which brought me into this sport. And if I hadn't been, who knows, you know, like I said, it changed the trajectory of my life. So yeah, I think definitely that's a huge part of it, which can be difficult and uncomfortable to do, but learning how to do that and move to go beyond, yeah, that's the whatever circle you're in and whatever it is within that sport. Because at some point, you know, the article statistics, we all know the percentages, you know, at some point that sport's not going to be there and you're going to need a different network, a broader network, right? And the more you can have those other interactions with other types of people, you know, it's not necessarily you have to always hang out or your best friends. It's just interacting with people who are doing different things, right? And that's when organic kind of opportunities and things happen, and you may not know when they happen or when they come back to happen, right? So I think you're exactly right. You know, that's a huge part of it. And that's a big selling point. I try to talk to kids to try something new, a new sport, right? It's like, just try this sport. And rowing, you know, rowers are, you know, are a strange breed, right? I mean, you see rowers anywhere, they'll start talking to each other right at the airport if they don't know each other, you know? And so I'm saying, hey, if you're a kid and you start rowing, you have to, you have a jacket on and it's a crew shirt, a rowing shirt, and you're somewhere at a Starbucks and somebody else is there and they see that, they, you know, that strikes up a conversation. Who knows? They have this or that, or they may have a job. You know, you never know what could happen, right? And that's the benefit of sort of getting out of your normal circle that you mentioned, even if it was that, you know, through that sport that you got into college with, is finding in that environment, you know, is always reaching out. And I also want to go back to the previous question. I mean, I think I was very fortunate, you know, Martin. I don't think it's, I'm not saying it's wrong to leverage that. You know, I think it's good to have understanding and understand where your opportunities are. But regardless, though, I still think even if you want to leverage, you know, something in that sense, it's always going to have to come down to the work and doing the work, right? And if without that, you're not going to get anywhere. But it's understanding, good to know what your opportunities are and where things are and to be realistic in that sense, right? But you have to bring it, I guess, sort of, you know, with the work, you know. And I you know, I was fortunate to have that support. And I think, unfortunately, as we see a lot across this whole country, especially at, you know, a lot of, in, you know, in the public, you know, education sphere, you know, with cuts to money and the resources, it's just, you know, how many of these kids are having that? I was fortunate to have that support at home, you know, with both my parents pushing, but how many kids have that support of a counselor, you know, pushing them to look higher, to look beyond, as the article brings up, looking up the ladder, not just looking at a place where it's sort of here, but, you know, looking where you could be. You know, a lot of the kids just don't have that support in many of these schools, right? The resources from school counselors or academic advisors, they just aren't there, or they're overworked and they can't give them that attention. And that's such a huge part of trying to open kids' eyes and see what their real potential could be, you know. And a part of it goes back then, of course, to getting outside and being comfortable, you know, Mike, as you're saying, to other circles.
Yeah, well, it brings up an interesting point, and thank you for the insight. I had a teammate at Oxford who ultimately, or not ultimately, but prior to Oxford, rowed at Harvard. But he was a swimmer in high school, wasn't at all a rower. And he positioned himself, knowing that he had a rower's frame, to the rowing coach, obviously had the grades, and he came in as a rowing recruit with a background of swimming. And clearly he knew that he was not going to be a Harvard-level swimmer, but that he could, through hard work, a Harvard-level rower, because they're all looking for people that are just willing to do the work, and we know what that's like. He was able to parlay that background into an offer that got into Harvard. And, you know, that is, it's exceptional, right? To know that rowing afforded him that opportunity. Not all sports are like that, of course, but that he had that kind of frame of mind. And then if you contrast that with the other example, every year there is, you know, a ranking in the state of the best basketball players in the state. And Dave, maybe you were on it back in the day, right? And what always it's funny for me just to see this, that on that list, presuming that they got grades of a certain standard, why would those kids not think of going to top tier schools? Because, you know, in the Ivy Leagues or in schools like it, though they might not get the shine of an NCAA tournament, but it's highly unlikely they'll make the pros anyway, they're the type of kids that if they have the grades, they could knock on those doors of those high achieving schools and those coaches would take them in a heartbeat. But yet they chose to go either, you know, the Duke route, which I guess can't argue with, but many of them would go a junior college route. Many of them would go a middle tier route. They'll go to some school they've never heard about and with these hopes of dreams of making the pros. And academics is so far on the back burner and the importance of networks is so far on the back burner that it's kind of like they're squandering the opportunity to hold tight to this dream that they might make the NBA without fully realizing the statistics involved.
Yeah. You mean as the kids themselves to see that other path?
Is that correct?
I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, when it's the sport you love, you're always going to kind of want to be, if you think you have another step to go, right? You're always going to maybe want to keep pushing if that stair step still goes up, right? And it's hard to see that, hey, you know, that ladder is at some point tower is going to end, right? And you're going to get that landing, but it's hard to feel it when you're in it, right? You're like, I can, if I keep going here, if I get this route, like you hear so many stories and it's very tough, right? And if there's nobody around you providing that insight to that other way or the other path, that you're right, you're never really going to hear it because everything you're getting in is going to be in one direction. And so, that's a very good point. Yeah. And you don't know why. It's a very good question of maybe why more kids don't choose a different path, but you know, and perhaps it is because of some of the other factors that you brought up in the articles. You know, just when you think of those schools, right? You know, money becomes an immediate. It's just a huge different hurdle, just a different whole kind of thing in someone's mind that kind of it's confusing. Don't even want to go that route, right? And so you stick to a route you know, a sport you love that you're always going to keep getting better at that age, right? And it's just, you know, we all know as we are kids, and I guess even as adults, it's tough. Like you said, you have those blinders on. Unless you have somebody else, some other help or support around you, I guess it can be really difficult to take those off. And that's a huge, yeah, it's a very interesting point of that you bring up.
You know, a very unique irony, I guess, is the Michigan Fab Five and Chris Webber scandal in the sense to where those guys went to school, and in the back of their minds, this is just the launching pad for us to go into the NBA. And if there are some adults or some people who are sponsoring us, quote unquote, with Chris Webber, where they're putting money in our pockets because we don't have any money, we can't go on a date, we can't get, you know, pizza or any of that kind of stuff. And so it did kind of highlight the fact that these universities are making grand theft money. They're marketing the shoes, they're marketing the uniforms, they're marketing the names. But back then, the athletes themselves wasn't getting a dime. Right. Now, with NIL, things are changing a little bit. I think it's mostly business. I don't think it's the universities that are actually paying the athlete. But do you think, working with younger students, talking to younger students, that a seed can be planted that, you know, if you're fortunate enough to get a scholarship, take advantage of that scholarship and don't just look at it as a way to enhance my athletic ability, but a way in which I personally, financially, business-wise, and so on, could benefit from going to that particular university? How do we plant that seed to young kids to start thinking that way?
Yeah, it's very difficult these days. You know, it's very challenging. You know, sometimes by the time you deal with high school kids, they're so old and think there's so many factors already at play. It can be really tough to, like you said, plant that seed. You know, and I think it's also just even tougher now, too, just the state of athletics overall across the board. I mean, I know here in Oakland, like, we're talking to some people, we're doing a lot of efforts. And you know, I think one of the big things we're trying to do is really a lot of different all sports across that whole youth sport spectrum, kind of finding ways to sort of support each other and band together, because you're seeing a lack of just overall, I think, in some cities, I know in Oakland, and in terms of participation of youth sports, right, there's hard to find like a gym where a kid could even go to play basketball, let alone an outdoor court or fields that are just, you know, in disrepair and just a lack of funding. So I think it's to trying to set that seed. I mean, I think it's really, I think it's going to come down to finding new ways to collaborate sort of with each other, you know, and finding ways to fight and start at as young as a level as you can, right? It's tough, I think, by the time the kids are in middle, in high school, you know, and then in this day and age with phones and video games, there's so many other issues and factors just getting kids outside to do something, right? And whether it's safe or not as well. So there's a whole lot of different issues at play. I guess in my mind, and yeah, the things we'll focus on, okay, how can we, I think, you know, it's hard. I think we need to work less in silos, right? So less, you know, within rowing or less within this. It's like, how can we find ways to provide these, find again, new safe places for kids to have after school activities and youth activities, and finding at that younger level to try to plant some of these seeds, right? And then, you know, the difficulty becomes though, is as the kids get older, again, who's helping to sort of shepherd the kids along, right? And make sure that they see that, you know, that water that seed in a ways, right? So they still see all these other opportunities that are out there, and the focus on scholarship, not just to, as we're talking about, to weigh a potential future in that particular activity, but really the whole kind of holistic nature of what a, you know, education can do and what it really can provide, right? And so I think it's a tough question, right? It's really tough. I guess my answer, yeah, again, would be to, I think we just need to look on collaborating with each other across this whole spectrum of youth sports in general, and finding ways to attack it, you know, in that way at a youngest age as possible. And then making sure there's resources there at all the steps along the way to help, you know, water that seed. By the way, I'd love to hear some other
ideas. Yeah, I'm just kind of so bringing this back to, you know, the importance of the education that you're receiving. I think at Stanford, you were afforded insight in a way that wasn't available to me at Penn. At Penn, I don't think anyone at the school foresaw themselves as a professional athlete upon graduation. And if they did, right, they viewed it through the lens of a national team where they weren't getting paid much. Clearly not basketball, sure, football, baseball, whatever, right? Yeah. Stanford is materially different. The football team nationally ranked, the baseball team nationally ranked, you know, the basketball team, you know, on occasion. I think that's probably takes a backseat to the other two. But, you know, Stanford is well known, at least on the top level, to have some very good programs. That as a club rower, you're extremely good yourself. But I would think that it's still a different conversation. You're not in the conversation of the resources for the football team, the track team, the baseball team. And some of those very much are looking at professional sports as their long-term play. And, you know, is that, were there people that were on those teams that were your peers, you know, wouldn't have gotten into Stanford if it wasn't for their athletic pedigree? And did they have to take kind of secondary or tertiary degree options just to even make it to practice, so that they really didn't leverage the Stanford education as well as they could have? And subsequently, they have this, you know, this school on their resume, but they didn't make the pros, but they would have been much better off at other schools focusing on things other than athletics. Or did Stanford do a very good job with those potential teens that are clearly coming to their school, hoping it to be a launching pad for a professional career? I only ask because that wasn't my environment, right? But it was kind of yours. Right. You were rubbing shoulders with them. And I'm curious, like, is it kind of a dual structure, which could be similar at, you know, Notre Dame, could be similar at other schools where there's kind of like a dual class system, and those kids, unfortunately, aren't able to leverage the education to their benefit?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I think, you know, obviously I'm not there now. It's been, you know, 20 years with it almost, right? But I guess when I was there, I think it definitely is a unique place in that front. You definitely had, whether it's a basketball team, men's and women's, right? Football team looking at the pros, or even track and field. It's a unique place where there's still like not a peer pressure, but a lot of people there, you know, there is a big focus on, you know, the education and what's afterwards. Because, you know, at the school, right, you know, someone may be doing, you know, be going to a sport in athletics, and that's a big deal. But at the same time, you're in the same class or living with somebody who's, you know, building a robot or founded a company, right? So you have like a bunch of different things going on where athletics are on a pedestal in a sense, but there's still people doing amazing things. I don't know. So I think it creates an overall culture of people really do. I don't know the numbers, right? I'm sure there are people, you know, on athletic teams or whatnot that didn't maybe perhaps have the same degrees or what you can say for that. But I think on the whole, though, I think people at the school generally, you know, there's still a big focus on it, you know, the grades and whether or not people talk about it or not. You know, a lot of people may downplay it, but they're still, you know, doing work. I don't know if that's the same at, you know, a bunch of different schools who may not have that same kind of, I guess, cultural, you know, element to it to still get grades and whatnot. And so it's a unique place that I don't know if you have that at all the different, you know, different universities or big state schools or what have you. Because like you said, in the Ivy Leagues, it's just not the same level in terms of athletics. You just don't have that element there too. And so that is definitely unique, and they combine sort of both of those together. And, you know, I think a state school is just so big and so massive. You know, there's a lot of areas and ways you could kind of drop off or fall off a little bit. So it was, I think, definitely a unique environment in that sense of kind of keeping people. There's a cultural element to just continuing to get good grades and something that's going to happen afterwards. I do think that's the truth.
It's also interesting, too. I think schools that really focus on high academic achievement, you know, like Stanford. I had a friend of mine who actually was on the crew team at Duke. And he was telling me, like, when he went to Duke, they didn't have athletic dorms. So all the athletes stayed in the same dorms as regular student population. And so I think that helps in regards to networking with other high-achieving people, not necessarily just those that are athletic, but those that may have different interests. You get introduced to different things, people from different cultures. So I think the school itself, you know, I think some of the higher standard schools tend to look at it that way, as a holistic approach as opposed to just an athletic endeavor.
Yeah, you're very right. Because even your freshman year, they make a point that, you know, you don't live with somebody on your team. You can't choose who you live with in that sense, right? So you could have a star recruit on a basketball team. They're going to live with somebody, you know, some random person, not random, but they're not going to be a teammate. So it forces you, even at, you know, that first year, you're interacting with new people and that's a very good point you bring up. If it starts immediately there, you know, and creates new interactions, it's a good point.
So good. So like talking about the article from an umbrella perspective, we're talking about how, you know, how can teens identify opportunities for what they are and then start to make kind of calculated decisions that impact themselves that are somewhat long view oriented to their benefit. And do you guys think it's almost too much to ask for teens to be able to do that? And it's only ever going to be the intrepid ones that can do it? Is there things that, you know, benefit, you know, both sides of the equation by making them more aware so that more kids can come to the table armed with the ability to make these forward-thinking decisions that benefit not only them, but also the schools that they would be looking to be a part of? And in some of the same ways that, you know, an old teammate of mine used swimming as an end around to get into Harvard, you know, that's a good example. And it clearly is not the only one. There could be a million different examples and a lot of different sports and a lot of different activities that accomplish the same thing. You know, did you guys have an opinion or a perspective on how, you know, the overall approach can be modified so that, you know, these types of choices aren't just the luxury of those that have, you know, the needed experience to even identify these openings?
Yeah. Do you want to go, Mike? Or you want me to?
From just my perspective, working with athletes, kids of color, at-risk kids, a lot, I think, is the corporate sponsorship. Like, I know there's that new Michael Jordan movie that's just coming out with Air. And if you look at a lot of the AAUs, it's mostly, you know, athletic wear. That's the sponsorship, Nike sponsorship. I think if corporations were to start sponsoring certain activities, then kids would probably get introduced to people in those particular fields. But since those that are involved in athletics tend to be sponsored by corporations that are looking for the next superstar, even though the percentage of those participating in it on the youth level is very small, it kind of narrows the focus a little bit. So if there is a way in which inner city, first generation college kids can be introduced to people from a variety of careers that actually make really good income, I think that could open up at least their eyes a little bit into, you know, pursuing other endeavors.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that's, yeah, kind of, I think sort of you kind of alluded to or talk, you know, sort of like sort of a gap right there. You know, there's what the school could provide, right? But then there's still going to be a gap sort of needs, and whether it is like part of it is like you said, having those relationships outside, which, you know, other businesses or things can help provide too. But I think there's some other things that, you know, the teams look at too in terms of, you know, sort of the gaps, right? And I think try to get a frame this a little bit. So like the Varsity Blues are very interesting, you know, and I think rowing's very susceptible to that. And I think it impacts it as well, trying to serve communities that don't have a history, you know, underserved communities within the sport, right? Because the junior rowing landscape is very diverse a lot of different levels, right? In terms of the quality of programs, quality of coaching, quality of et cetera, right? So you know, you have a kid who's clearly potentially got talent, right? Maybe it's a 6'2", you know, young woman, or 6'8", you know, young man, right? Clearly has potential, an interest in the sport, but maybe doesn't have that level of coaching or quality yet to be able to put up the right numbers to get recruited, right? The right ERG score, ergometer score on the rowing machine to get recruited. And so I think if you're a coach and it's an interest and there's a connection, there's maybe you want to do something there. It's like, it can be tricky. Or before Varsity Blues, and go, yeah, coaches should take why would you not take a chance on, you know, that kind of potential, right? But then it kind of leads itself to potential situations where, you know, kids are getting recruited, you know, it could be really potential, or it could be kind of these fake, areas. So there's sort of some gaps there in trying to connect, you know, that level of it. And so, you know, how do we solve that? But then another part of it too is, right, if you're looking to get, you know, underserved kids into sports and their scholarships and things involved, right, you know, it's very difficult to get a full ride anywhere, you know, in a sport, unless you're, you know, at the top of your sport and at the high school or the junior level. You know, it's tough to get a full ride anywhere. So there's always going to be these conversations, I think, around money, and there's always going to be a gap there, right? And I think if you're a coach, it could be difficult, right, in terms of making some of those decisions. And that's where it's less sort of simple in terms of saying, yeah, you're just going to always choose to go with a potential kid, because you're always going to have these other elements that, you know, kind of at play and at push and pull. And that's where I see other areas, like, as you brought up, Michael, you know, businesses or even, you know, looking at alumni groups, or, you know, where's a way you can kind of help sort of bridge that gap, to provide some other resources to help develop that potential that maybe the school can't factor in. So maybe you have a kid, right, who's talented, he wants to go to the school, a school can't give them a full ride, they can give them some money, but there's some gap there, you know. But maybe there's a way at some of these alumni programs where things are set up, or there's other avenues for quote-unquote scholarships to help sort of bridge that gap, where you can navigate, you know, around some of these certain areas, and can kind of, obviously you're going to be looking at a kid who's serious at that point in time. It's not a kid with a fake resume, he wasn't ever really part of that sport, but, you know, there's ways to kind of go deeper. So I think there's a gap there in terms of, you know, some of the pressures that coaches face, whether, you know, it's a limited amount of scholarship money or ability to help serve kids or underserved kids, and then kind of actually getting them into the point where they can get into the sport and feel like they're stable and being able to compete and to participate. So I think some of the area you talked about, you know, is part of that solution, you know, in terms of bringing in the community resources around just the school and just the, you know, its own resources in and of itself, whether it's alumni groups, local businesses, or whatever, trying to help solve that problem and to bring kids in. Because I guess the kid you talked about who was the swimmer in high school, you know, some coach made a decision based off their potential, right? But they probably didn't get, you know, a full ride. They probably had some gap of resources that allow them to get in there, to get, come up to speed, to, you know, to capitalize on that potential, right? And so they probably were fortunate to have some type of gap to be able to cover it. But, you know, not every kid can do that. And so how do we solve that problem?
That's very true. And you know, that was a white male, and that's not to say white males are affluent. Yeah. That's a false statement, but your point is well made. But when I started the inner city rowing team, the easy conversation to have with people was, you know, not all 6'8" African-American kids on the south side of Chicago want to play basketball. Some of them might want to be artists. Some of them might not want to be athletes at all, but
right,
why not them also try rowing, because this could help. And there's not a lot of black kids on the Penn rowing team. There clearly was a couple on Stanford, but not many either, right? They, and I talked about like the commoditization you know, and right. that sounds like an overly negative term and completely out of context. You're correct to think it is negative, but if you flip it around from a positive context, you know, that gentleman that was in high school that used rowing commoditized himself, and that gave him that opportunity to get that acceptance into Harvard. And, you know, and this theoretical 6'8" kid on the south side of Chicago could theoretically do the same. And what are your thoughts on kind of the ethics and the morals of someone kind of leveraging their background to try to, in a sense, commoditize themselves to better the odds to then get into places that they otherwise wouldn't had they not used that avenue? And then I guess as a sidebar question, you know, how do we make it clear to those kids that this is even an option?
That's a very good question. Do you want to go, Michael, or you? I guess, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And when you bring in the ethics of it, sorry, do you want to go ahead, Mike? Or?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was on mute. I think the next month in June, they're having a Black Business Expo, some group is sponsoring and whatever. And Magic is going to be one of the keynote speakers. And they were going to bring in some other successful business people. And the target audience, of course, is people who want to go future entrepreneurs, but they're also going to look at a lot of youth. And I think that if there were a way in which these types of professionals can interact with potential college athletes and let them know that, hey, these universities and so on are making some money off of you. So you want to make sure you take advantage of your time that's there. I don't know how often that discussion is being made with young people, but I think if it is there, then you won't get all, but there will be a percentage, especially on the fringe, that, hey, yeah, I want to be a professional athlete, but I also want to pursue something else. And I think those discussions, even this particular episode where we're bringing, you know, past successful athletes who are successful in other arenas as well, is a vehicle in which kids need to hear. They need to understand it and they need to listen to it. So I think those types of strategies is one way in which these potential future athletes could go to universities with a different type of mindset and a different type of attitude.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's a common thing is trying to get just introduced to, you know, new people, new networks, and just to see what's out there, to see how high that ladder can go. And you know, and then kind of, you know, back to part of the question too, I mean, is it ethical and moral to leverage? I mean, you know, the old, in every industry and every business and every, you know, everywhere in this country, I guess in the world too, that, you know, the old boys network has been at play for, you know, hundreds of years. So why is it not okay for, you know, people in certain, you know, communities, certain people to, you know, to take advantage and leverage, you know, what they have and what opportunities they could be in front of them. So it's hard for me to say that's, you know, not ethical or unethical. I mean, I wasn't necessarily looking in that frame. I mean, I think it's important to know, again, yeah, what opportunities you may have, you know, what's out there and what can get you the best way to get there. And I guess my only caveat to that is to say, I guess if you're thinking, you know, somebody's thinking that they can leverage that and that's going to be good and that's all they have to do, that, you know, I think you fall short, right? Again, you have to understand what your opportunities are and what you can leverage, but at the same time, you still have to, you know, put something down on the paper, right? You still have to be able to produce, still have to be able to do work, right? You have to work hard and you have to, you know, always constantly, you know, keep trying to improve and keep trying to push. And without that hard work, without that piece of it, you know, maybe that's where things become somewhat unethical in those sorts, if you think you're going to get by certain ways. But, you know, we're always going to need, wherever you are, is leverage what you have and what you can get, you know, to hopefully move forward, you know, for the better, you know, hopefully it's not done in a way at the expense of others, right? I think that's where it's important to focus again back on the, you know, on the institutions themselves and what, you know, what stop gaps, what things they have in place to be able to realize when things may be crossing those boundaries and to best understand them, right? And that's why it's important, you know, diversity is huge and important. You want a diversity of thought, diversity of perspectives in certain rooms at those higher levels to make sure people are always asking the certain questions or always, you know, always checking, always looking a little bit further, not just to, you know, relying on that network to take care of it. But you always have sort of those stop measures, those stop gap to make sure you don't have those abuses. You don't have those instances where things cross a, you know, even a moral or ethical or boundary, right? So it's not just the onus on the individual, but, you know, real onus on our institutions, you know, and how they're comprised and what's made, you know, what they're made up of, who's in those rooms, and, you know, looking at the various things that come across their plate. So I think you have to go kind of look at it in two rounds. But at the end of the day, yeah, we're always going to want to leverage what we have, you know, to hopefully get better. And again, hopefully not do it where you're stepping over somebody and, you know, in a negative way. And always making sure you're focused at what you're doing at the task at hand and make sure you work hard at that. Because without that, you know, nothing's going to happen. You won't get anywhere. You're going to, at some point, you know, fall off the cliff a little bit. So.
Yeah, I definitely want to support the statement that, you know, without the work, all of this is pointless. And, you know, you got to be able to do the work. And I think, you know, David, you know, our background as rowers kind of exemplify that, because, you know, outside of maybe a few handpicked examples, you know, most rowers are made, right? They're not born. And so you have to enjoy the work. You have to look at the long term. You have to fight for every inch. You need to deconstruct what you're doing. But what is nice is the sport clearly and very often rewards that effort. So you see it in real time. It might take a while. And I think that is a respective privilege that we have as being alumni of the sport, because we see it reinforced time and time again, that that's how we then view the world afterwards, right? If we're willing to do the work, chip away at stuff and look at all the angles, it's going to work out for us. And a lot of other sports aren't really like that, right? I mean, if you are a sprinter, you're either naturally faster or not. You could be marginally faster with a lot of training, but if you don't have that God-given ability to be quick, no amount of training is going to work for you unless you have to go down the route of drugs or something, right? And that's not really a world that rowers play in. Would you say that's kind of a fair statement?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely a fair statement. Sort of the nature of, yeah, of the sport requires some of that. Definitely have to.
Yeah, we're always fighting for the inches, and we're always looking at angles to play where we can be as efficient as possible. And I think in some ways that's a luxury that other sports and other people that doesn't come as natural to them. And I think that's the one I struggle with sometimes, is because when I'm looking at all these angles to play, I think that is born out of my years involved in the sport, where all we ever did was look at every single angle to play because we had to. And other people don't necessarily do that, so it doesn't come natural to them. So then a bunch of opportunities get missed.
Right. No, that's a very good point. Yeah, it forces you to look at those angles. You know, it's something that just popped in my head too. I mean, you know, kind of going back to the moral and ethical. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you want to say, okay, well, where do you draw that line, right? And maybe it's something recently you talk about, like money, right? You don't want everyone to get over what they have. You know, use that money as the thing that they're leveraging to get over on the next person. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you have to look, kind of a good point, you know, Mike brought up, is that, you know, maybe in a situation where you have this forum where you're connecting athletes with, you know, people with business who do have resources. And then if they can somehow use those resources to help this kid out in a certain way, you know, so it's not like a fine line you can draw and say, you know, you don't want anything to do with money. That's where you cross a line. Well, there's some instances, well, what's leverage that? Leverage certain networks, right? Leverage certain networks where there's businesses in the Black community or with Latino community, whatever community it is, to help, you know, the youth in that community move up, right? And so it's not as a black and white necessarily. And that's, again, where it comes back to who are those institutions are kind of.
So I thank you very much for your time. I'll stand back. You guys can give some last thoughts, and then we'll just wrap it up and, you know, continue on with you today. David, I thank you for your friendship and your willingness to be involved.
For me, as always, this has been very insightful. David, I appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation with you and applaud you on your past as well as continued success. You're definitely a role model, and I think the more we can have a variety of people be introduced to people like yourself, I think benefits us all. So I appreciate you taking some time today to be on today's podcast.
Yeah, thank you both. Yeah, thank you, Michael. And thank you, Montana, for having me. Really great questions, really great ideas. You definitely have my mind kind of spinning and going certain directions right now. And I really, you know, enjoy the conversation. And, you know, I think the great theme across, you know, I think all we're doing is, you know, we're all trying to work together, you know, to solve the problems. And I think that's a big part of it, you know, in finding ways that to support each other, support the youth who are always that next generation is huge. And thank you all for all that you guys are doing. And thanks for having me today.
Thank you for listening to the Information Asymmetry Podcast. You've now been given some knowledge. Use it. This has been an exclusive Thin Edge production.